Welcome to Herald Extra. This is the podcast for the Presbyterian Herald, which is the official magazine of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. I'm Sarah Harding, the editor of the Herald, and this is the first episode of our podcast. We hope you will enjoy taking a behind-the-scenes look at the magazine as we delve deeper into a couple of the articles in each edition. To make sure you don't miss any future episodes, you can subscribe by searching for Herald Extra in your favourite podcast software. Today we're focusing on the November edition, and joining me around the table are Alan Mabin, a freelance writer and blogger, and Karen Jardine, who is PCI's Public Affairs Officer. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Alan, if I could turn to you first, you interviewed Philip Yancey for this edition, and originally you were supposed to go over to London to meet him, but that didn't quite work out.
Yeah, it was one of those, wouldn't it be nice if it would work the way it's meant to?
Yeah.
He was coming over to the UK to do kind of a book tour. He's got the new book out, maybe we'll talk about that in a minute. And he's got four dates, kind of talking to big groups across England. And the idea was we kind of go to London, his publisher had set up a whole day of seeing things. He was then going to travel on somewhere kind of further east in the world, and his visa didn't come through, and then his whole travel plans changed, and we ended up doing it by phone, which is much more traditional, actually, kind of talking to people and just recording it. And he was in some kind of soundproof booth. His publisher's quite nice. And they had kind of trendy offices. And so he was in this kind of little carpeted room. So it was a really nice sound, actually. I've kind of no idea how old he is, because I haven't seen him. He's just kind of lovely. He's got this lovely voice. I kind of feel like I've known him for 20 minutes, but... we didn't actually, but we had a good chat.
Yeah, is it harder to build a rapport then if you're not actually face-to-face?
Well, there's no body language, there's no kind of looking into your eyes. I'm kind of realising, are you telling me the whole thing or is there another bit I can ask you about? But it's okay, it's easier to transcribe actually probably because it's shorter.
Yes.
And I suppose one of the secrets, if you want a behind-the-scenes thing, is the fact that after about 20 minutes we just stopped. I mean, there's hundreds of things you could ask him. He's a really interesting guy.
Yeah.
But actually, you don't want to have... If he told you, you might have to write it up.
Yeah.
And you don't have that many pages in the Herald for an article for me to, you know, to do it. So we kind of talked about a few things and then we stopped.
And did you find he was quite open to everything that you asked him?
I mean, he's a journalist by trade. He kind of makes the point that he's not a... You know, he has done a wee bit of theological training, but not. He's a writer and a journalist, and now a speaker. But he talks easily, and he kind of knows how the trade works, and he knows. I think he's quite deliberate about what he says. There's certain stories. There were things when I asked him about some stuff. We kind of talked a bit about some of the issues that are affecting churches generally across the world. There's some common things, and he said, "Yeah, because when I didn't mean to kind of tell this story in England when I was here, but I have been." And then he kind of related the story about South Korea and the pastor who's been dealing with kind of babies that are unwanted, and having a kind of basically a baby box that you can put the baby in, and the church will then try and find homes to look after them. You know, so that kind of story he hadn't planned. He didn't think that was relevant to the book that he was trying to promote, but actually it was relevant to the conversation everybody wanted to have.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about the book. He's currently promoting, it's actually an updated version of a book that he wrote with a doctor in the 1980s.
His wife actually came across Dr. Paul Brand, who was it's kind of like a leprosy doctor, who English, but spent most of his life working in India with patients with leprosy. And his wife found a pamphlet that he'd written when she was looking through in her library for some other stuff. And said, "You want to read this?" Because it was a set of talks I think he'd given. He kind of using the body as an analogy and a metaphor for the body of Christ and how our cells work and how our bodies kind of fight with ourselves and how that works with the church. He visited Paul. He kind of spent, I think, a few days kind of just like wandering around the wards after him to discover it. I wouldn't say fell in love, but he fell in love with the character of this man who could apply his faith. And also was kind of this servant of people who generally nobody wanted to work with. And it turned out Paul Brand is quite revolutionary. He kind of changed how you deal with leprosy. He was much more hands-on. He was not afraid of touching. The book talks about the fact that touch is really important, that that's a really human thing and a healing thing. Even if your body can't be healed, at least your mind will know the presence of other people. So they'd written two books together. And then he decided to update it. He thinks the science has moved on a wee bit. There's a wee bit more explanation of how things happen. And so they've kind of merged them together. So fearfully and wonderfully, the marvel of bearing God's image is the collation of those two books. The strange thing is, of course, it's written first person from the point of view of Paul Brand. Now, Paul died about a decade ago.
Okay.
So actually, but they've continued. The book is, because it was based on his writings, and then Philip Yancey kind of changed it and modified it and made it bigger. But he's allowed Paul to kind of have the voice of the book, which, so for people who are into Philip Yancey and who doesn't have one or two on their bookshelves because it makes you feel very orthodox, you know, it's an unusual one because it's written from somebody else's perspective, yeah. And you're actually in the head of a doctor who deals with leprosy patients, and it's an interesting book.
Okay. One particular point that stood out to me is kind of connected to that story that you mentioned there about the babies in Korea. And Yancey said, "We can't each bear all the world's suffering at once." And then he makes the point that we need to focus on what we as individuals can do to show God's love to others. And mentioning that minister who in Korea who was doing something very individually to help those babies. Do you think that's a message that we in the church just aren't embracing enough?
Yeah, I mean, as the comment came out of it, I'd asked him a question. I'm not sure. The Herald article probably has a much shorter version of my question, which was more rambling. We're kind of talking about the fact that there's a whole set of issues. We could name some of them, like same-sex marriage and abortion, and that there's any number of other things that the church is kind of somewhat obsessing with at the moment, and it's facing lots of denominations. And as part his answer to, well, how should the church deal with that when it thinks about its body and the body of Christ, he pointed out that sometimes we've got to do things at an individual level instead of kind of fixing the entire planet. We've got to fix the people who are in front of us. And in doing that, maybe we learn about the bigger picture as well. And there's room for both doing big, kind of big picture stuff and then little small individual relational things as well. And I think that's something that it does apply. You know, sometimes if we look at General Assembly as an example of the church, or if we look at presbytery meetings, or, you know, we're looking at big issues. We're trying to come up with a stance. That's kind of part of, I think, what your job is. We're going to hear in a wee minute. You know, and we're trying to come up with a big picture. And yet, actually, all of those big picture things affect individual people. And if we spent even longer working with individuals on the ground, we would learn and listen and hear so much from them that it would probably inform and give us what our big picture view should be. So we're doing it less academically and we're doing it more out of relationship with people. Yeah. So I think listening is kind of really important in all of this. And I think that's what Paul Brand was doing with his leprosy patients. He was listening to them, and he was learning from them and then saying, "Oh, I wonder would this work if I tried that?" He wasn't just the doctor on high who knew the answers. And I think as church, we need to be not on high. We need to be kind of always listening and ready to kind of go, that could be challenging. I wonder how we react to that.
Yeah. Well, Karen, your job is very much that bigger picture, as Alan was talking about. And another thing that Philip Yancey mentioned in that article was about disagreeing well. And he was primarily talking about how we do that better in the church. But I'm sure in your role as public affairs officer, that's something you come up against all the time.
I think, Sarah, that's not actually something that's just unique to the church and in society as a whole. We've just lost that art of agreeing to disagree or disagreeing well. And I suppose in some senses, we're being told that the world is less binary than it was, and it's kind of all sorts of fluidity going around. But actually, public discourse seems to fall down to a binary choice between you either agree with me or you disagree with me. Yeah. And if you disagree with me, then that's it. And I think that's the case. You hear it on radio programmes, you see it in newspapers, letters, pages, you see it all around us, you see it even in families. Where people can't talk about issues like Brexit within their families because it's so divisive, and so then you just set it to one side. And I think probably another issue is around in society around kind of trust and truth, and so people don't trust maybe like what big institutions say anymore, and PCI is seen to be a big institution, and so whenever it speaks, people then sometimes hear it with that sense of mistrust that they apply to other institutions like Westminster or the Assembly or other big things where they feel that they're maybe not in agreement with.
Well, you wrote a great article in the November edition on human rights. And in the article, you clearly define the term and you outline how PCI is working to engage with the issue of rights. Now, it is a subject that can sometimes be seen as controversial in church circles because human rights can be seen as justifying behaviour or maybe pushing forward ideas that the church is either uncomfortable with or even against. Do you think that the church should be wary of talking about human rights?
I think that human rights is actually a very Christian concept. We're all made in the image of God, and I think it's about, and so as Christians we believe that's where our rights come from or where humanity comes from in that. And I suppose the issue is that from a church perspective or a Christian perspective, we come at the argument from a different place, from a different foundational place than say, the human rights institutions or human rights discourse in the rest of the world. So, for example, Alan's already mentioned some of the debates around abortion. So just to pick that up, because it's the one that's pressing at the moment. The human rights institutions, based on international law and the Paris principles, say that life begins at birth. And that's very fundamentally different to where we believe value and human dignity begins, because of what we believe about scripture. So our scriptural point and those two points are two opposing points, and we're not going to make each other change our minds on those things. So then that goes back to your first question, well, how do we disagree well, and how do we find a way to both speak into the public square on those things? But I think as well, in terms of church, we shouldn't be wary of human rights, because actually there's many instances across the world and globally where we call on human rights to protect brothers and sisters in the faith who are persecuted, because we want to see their human rights. Or we get involved in things like the World Development Appeal, because we believe that people need access to clean water, they need access to places where they can live safely. And so that is actually a human rights based approach, although we are coming at it from a biblical scriptural basis rather than necessarily how it's framed within the world.
Yeah. Just picking up on that idea of abortion, it has obviously, as you say, been in the news north and south of the border recently. And the Herald actually received a couple of letters that are going to appear in the December-January edition. And they don't disagree with the fact that the church needs to address the issue, but they do make the point that abortion seems the issue that the church talks about the loudest at the moment. So how would you respond to that?
I suppose timing is everything, and the reason why it's being talked about loudly at the moment is because at this particular point in time, there's a consultation about a very radical shift in abortion provision in Northern Ireland, and that comes in the back of an extremely radical shift within the Republic of Ireland. So these things are out there in terms of policy, and so that's what we're talking, how we're talking about them and why we're talking about them. But these aren't the only things that the church engages with in the public square. So in terms of the abortion conversation, talk about a pregnancy crisis situation. Well, what causes the crisis? Poverty causes a crisis. Mm-hmm. People feeling that it will be difficult if a child is born with a disability. How will they cope with that in society? But as PCI as a whole, we respond to those things. So, for example, on a policy level, we put in a submission to an inquiry that was being held through one of the House of Commons committees about welfare reform, and there's significant changes to that happening. Back whenever welfare reform mitigations were put into place in 2015, the churches were at the forefront of that through PCI's own social witness work. The different residential and day centres for adults with significant disabilities all show a very practical response. So yes, we talk about these things in the public square, and this happens to be the issue of the day, but it's not the only thing that we ever talk about. And I think, just going back to what Alan was saying around that kind of whole big picture and the relational things, some people have said to me, well, the church is saying what it's against, but the church is not saying how do we support, what do we do for? And PCI is made up of hundreds of congregations with thousands of people that sit in the pews day by day. So yes, we're doing this stuff up at this level here into the public square, but at congregational level, people are actually doing stuff already that they don't even know. So something that feels quite simple in a way, and I know it's not simple for the people who run these things, but a parent and toddler group where maybe parents, mums, dads, grandparents come in from the community, get to know people from the church, and if there is a crisis in that family, people can get alongside. And people don't realise that that's significant. They just do it because that's what they do. And again, churches that support food banks, we don't want food banks in our society, but it's a means in which we can help those who are facing financial difficulty. So they might seem small, but actually they have a significant impact. And so it's about joining together, as Alan was saying, what's going up here with what's going down here, and also then allowing what's happening at congregational level to inform then what's happening or how we speak into the public square as well.
Yeah. And sometimes it's about being heard to do those things, because what happens at a congregational level tends to be quite private.
Yes.
Tends to be people's privacy is kind of paramount, and we don't often hear those stories. So we don't actually realise that across the island there are hundreds and hundreds of congregations who are doing what David Cameron called big society, and then stopped calling it that. But that's what the churches have been doing for 2,000 years and continue to do. And it's part of their DNA. It's part of what Christ called us to do. But I don't think the church often gets the credit for it. And sometimes that's because we don't talk about it, and then nobody realises. And then it's very easy to say, well, yeah, you're against this, but you don't seem to be helping anybody who's affected by it. And so it's partly, I guess it must be tricky in your job, Karen, because you need to figure out
what it is you say in the public square. There's only so many words you can use, so only so many times opportunities you have, and you also have to listen a lot of the time, rather than just always be the one kind of talking as a denomination. So
absolutely, and following the referendum result in 2018, there was a resolution passed at the General Assembly that year, an initiative that came from ministers in the Republic of Ireland about how does the church better respond to women and families who find themselves in a pregnancy crisis situation, or who are dealing with pregnancy loss, or subsequently caring for a loved one who's been born with a disability, either learning or physical. And so there's a small group looking at that. It's got headed up by Richard Houston from Lucan Presbyterian. It has representation from north and south of the border, medical professionals, as well as ministers and people who are living through this as well. And so, but that's only part of the conversation. So yes, there will be something centrally that the church is doing, but that it can't all just stop here. It can't all just be what happens in assembly buildings. It has to be that both and.
Yeah, local level. And if we think about the bigger picture at that higher level, do you think that one of the most difficult things for our church when engaging in the public square is the manner in which we articulate our views?
When we speak into the public square, we have to be mindful that we are cutting across people's own personal and private experiences. And as Alan said, like, a lot of those things are never told and or talked about, maybe than just a small group of people or friends or between a minister and an elder and someone. And I suppose as we speak into the public square, those are the things that we need to be mindful of. Not everything that is said publicly from the church is going to be agreed with by a wider society, but we still have an opportunity to have our voice heard. But we need to be careful about the tone in which we speak, the way in which we speak, the words that we use, and mindful of how those things are heard by other people.
Yeah. Alan, you asked Philip Yancey about Donald Trump, someone who has clearly polarised American society and is often blamed for the trend towards people with opposing views failing to disagree well, as we were talking about. Philip makes the point that he doesn't see any of the fruits of the spirit in Trump's behaviour. Do you think that that's the key point in our public square voice, that it's as much about how we say things as what we say?
Yes, it would be the short answer. I think in all communication, we need to figure out, depending on where you are and who you are and who's listening and who you want to lobby and the change you're trying to affect, you kind of need a strategy for how you talk. And normally we do that. If we are sitting in the room here, we're all kind of speaking about the same level. We're giving each other good eye contact. You know, so we develop our communication in order to make the impact we need. And sometimes I think as organisations, we speak and we're kind of sometimes a bit tone deaf. Sometimes we get it just right, and there are moments when the Presbyterian Church has said things that have been really apt during the Troubles, during things more recently, talking to political leaders. Sometimes they can call kind of truth to power, and that really works. And then sometimes it just kind of feels as if the organisation, the Borg, has kind of spoken, and it kind of doesn't have a personality and an emotion and an emotional intelligence sometimes. That must be really difficult. I'm glad I don't work for a denomination, because I think that's quite tricky to achieve.
Just coming in on that, like, so we have been launching this month our book, Considering Grace, Presbyterians in the Troubles, and I think that just is such a, yeah. The stories in that book really reflect that, where what was maybe happening at church institutional level wasn't really hitting where people were privately in their own kind of pain and grief, and yet other people who in their own pain and grief were supportive of different initiatives that the church was undertaking. And so I think although that book is about the Troubles, there are actually quite a lot of lessons to be learnt and can be applied in other aspects of life in terms of, or in other aspects of how the church speaks into things.
And I think if Yancey had talked about Trump back in 2016, and he gave, there's quite a good quote if you look it up online, and so I've kind of felt confident at the end to throw in some colour. You always need something to kind of not always be just about the book they're trying to flog, but also talk about real life and all the things that are going on. And I think if we look at our Facebook feeds and our news, we're constantly seeing things about Trump. We're also constantly seeing quite a lot of things that are either saying, you know, kind of Trump is called by God to be president, or those evangelicals who support Trump are kind of evil people kind of leading us astray away from the gospel. And there's this kind of binary kind of going on. And I was kind of interested that he's one of the few people who we kind of know the name of, Yancey, who's actually spoken out in a way that we could quote to say, he goes, I'm really not sure what's going on here, and I'm not comfortable about what the church is doing. And I think for me, that question comes back to Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and actually how we deal with the various political and social changes that are going on, and how do we not fall into the same traps, maybe, that other people are giving us great examples of how not to do it. You know, how do we make sure that we have leaders in a denomination in your town, or kind of sitting in a general assembly or talking on the media, that actually can give a little bit of both, a bit of leadership, but also a bit of listening and a bit of compassion at the same time. You can't get it right all the time, but you need to try.
Need to try. Yeah. Well, we'll leave it at that. That just about wraps up this episode of Herald Extra. My thanks to Alan Mabin and Karen Jardine for joining me and talking about the background to their articles in the November edition of the magazine. I'll be back soon with some more guests to delve deeper into the December-January double edition. Remember, if you don't currently subscribe to the Herald magazine, a digital version is available, and you can find out how to access it on the PCI website at presbyterianireland.org/herald. And you can subscribe to Herald Extra in your favourite podcast software to make sure you don't miss the next episode. Thanks for listening today, and goodbye.